Support for NPR podcasts comes from Bose. Bose sound in a portable iPod speaker system. Learn more about the SoundDock portable music system at Bose.com.
Hello and welcome to A Red Letter Day, the story of jazz, all this great audience, and incidentally a lot of profession around as far as I can see, all here to do honour to the greatest man in the story of jazz. Ladies and gentlemen, we present Mr. Duke Ellington.
Thank you. Thanks very much, ladies and gentlemen. Our first selection now, we usually give our audience three guesses as to what the title is, but you're so hip, we just don't dare.
To my way of thinking, no matter what one does in life, it should always be the personal best that you can strive for.
Do you think that Duke Ellington did this all the time?
All the time. It's not something I think, it's something I know.
So you knew Duke pretty well.
I watched him, I was around him, mm-hmm. and I saw he was just like his music, a great man. There is an aura about men like that.
As musicians Wynton Marsalis and Roland Hanna discussed, there was an aura about the man, but also about his band. Duke Ellington assembled history's greatest jazz orchestra, and he kept it going for almost 50 years. Many of his musicians stayed with him for decades, and Ellington inspired them to give the best performances we have of his music. A commanding presence on the bandstand, he was both elegant and eloquent.
When Ellington gave you an introduction, if he was introducing Ray Nance or Harry Carney or Clark Terry or myself, you better hang on to that, because that's the best introduction you're ever going to have in your whole life.
He could sense people in the audience who would respond, and he would sort of play to them, you know, like smiling and say, ha-ha, you know.
And of course, the audiences all fell in love with him because he loved everybody. You know, I mean, you're going to have somebody looking out saying, I love you madly. And he looked at his audience and made them believe it.
Duke Ellington was a remarkable leader who handpicked a band that is still considered one of the greatest in the history of this music. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, our first look into the genius of Duke Ellington, the band leader. In the swing era of the 1930s and 40s, leading a big band was a challenge that few musicians could meet. A band leader had to be part artist and part businessman, the glue that held the orchestra together, and the ubiquitous presence that charmed audiences. Duke Ellington excelled at both. Trumpeter Clark Terry worked with Ellington for 9 years.
He was a very charming person, a very beautiful person, a warm-hearted person, one who would be just totally loved by anybody who meets him the first time, a touching person.
Drummer Louis Belson worked with Ellington for 10 years.
Nobody had any arguments with Ellington. He was so complete, you know. That heart was so big, he had time for everybody.
Most people remember Duke Ellington as a composer and band leader, but he began his career in Washington, D.C., as a piano-playing sideman, an aspiring musician with a small repertoire. Ellington's first drummer and longtime associate, Sonny Greer.
And he wasn't even professional, but he could play piano. He could play two or three numbers, he could play piano.
Ellington and Greer left Washington together in 1923 to try their luck in New York. They first played in Wilbur Sweatman's band, then Elmer Snowden's Novelty Orchestra, which Ellington would soon take over. They were joined by the fabled trumpeter, Bubba Miley, whose tremendous talent for improvisation and raw, gritty plunger-mute style helped ignite the band's reputation.
Bubba Miley was coming really out the New Orleans tradition of muted playing of King Oliver.
Trumpeter Wynton Marsalis.
He had a tremendous influence on the band and on Duke. He also had that kind of wildcat spirit, a lot of fire. You never knew what he was going to do, what would come out of his horn, but you know that whatever came out was going to be soulful and creative. And he influenced the band with the growling and the different type of effects. And also the attitude, that type of soulful arrogance.
East St. Louis, Total O, an early composition by Ellington and Bubba Miley. Into the mid-20s, Ellington was learning how to orchestrate for his band, composer and conductor Gunther Schuller.
The question of how he learned all of that, one of the answers is that he did it entirely by himself. I mean, he really was untutored in these matters, and he's a totally self-made musician and composer. I mean, he did study a little piano, but as far as composing and arranging, he listened a lot. He hung out with one of his friends whom he admired, Will Vodary, who was an arranger for the Ziegfeld Follies, a black man who was fortunate enough to work for, you know, one of the biggest white successes in Broadway. And he picked up things from him, but there was no formal training that Ellington ever had in these matters.
From the very beginning, Ellington's music sounded different from that of other band leaders. And not only did the music attract attention, the handsome young man did too, pianist and educator Billy Taylor.
I mean, he was from not a rich family, but certainly an upper middle class family that aspired to have the very best for the younger members, the next generation of their family. So his father, who was a very elegant person, passed this on to Duke, and Duke saw plenty of examples of elegance and of people who appreciated the more comfortable things in life, nice clothes, or nice house, or good things to eat, and so forth. He was aware of this kind of thing, and when he got to the place where he could afford it, he insisted on that.
Pianist and writer Dempsey Travis.
Duke's high concept of himself relates back to the way his mother treated him and the way she reminded him that he was something very special. She loved him to death. I mean, she she didn't want his little feet to touch the ground.
Band leader Cab Calloway said that young Ellington, a handsome, almost shy-looking man with his hair brushed straight back and a thin mustache, had a special air of self-assurance and carried it with him all the time. In 1926, at a date at New York's Kentucky Club, he commanded the attention of an ambitious New York music publisher and promoter named Irving Mills.
One day, I went down to a little club, and the boss said to me, Mills, I've got a new band just came in from Washington. Let me know what you think of them. I heard the band, and I knew immediately this is the band that I want to build up for the best black band in the country.
Thank you. Mills became not only their business manager, but much more. He remade their image, down to the very clothes they wore, with added touches by Ellington. Billy Taylor.
Instead of wearing a black tie and tux or a regular tails or something like that, he wore white satin tails. Or the band had off-color, light gray tails. It was just something that was unique. You didn't see that if you went to a party or you went to a dance, but it was elegant. I mean, everybody looked as though they were dressed to the nines.
Ellington's career was gaining momentum. It became unstoppable after the band won an audition at the legendary Cotton Club in Harlem, where they became the house band from 1927 to 1931. Ellington biographer John Edward Hassey.
During the Cotton Club period, Ellington honed his sense of pacing and showmanship. The Cotton Club became the most prestigious and celebrated venue in all of Harlem, and a tremendous drawing card for the late night set who wanted something to do after going to the Broadway theater.
On stage nightly, Ellington developed an assured and gracious stage persona. He reached far beyond the role of bandleader to play that of elegant host. Longtime Ellington vocalist, Joya Sherrill.
And of course, the audiences all fell in love with him because he loved everybody. You know, I mean, you're going to have somebody looking out saying, I love you madly. You know, I mean, are you going to like that or not? You're going to love it, you know. And he looked at his audience and made them believe it, you know.
Trumpeter Clark Terry.
Maestro had a little way of experiencing this feedback from people because he could sense people in the audience who would respond, and he would sort of play to them, you know, like smile a little bit, say, ha-ha, you know, and so much so till the person or the people to whom he was referring would feel like they were actually a part of the whole thing. Oh, he's doing this for me. Wow, I'm a part of this, you know. And as a result, the feedback, you know, just created a certain amount of electricity that he loved, and he knew how to garner this. He knew how to get it out of people.
It's a look into the genius of Duke Ellington, the band leader, on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. Ellington's relationship to his audience at the Cotton Club was complicated by the fierce racial barriers in force in the late 20s. He was literally kept at an arm's length from his fans. But he found ways around this. Billy Taylor.
Because of racial prejudice, he could not sit with the patrons who came to see him, many of whom were extremely famous, and all of whom came back to his dressing room and crowded in and so forth. But he began at that point to send signals out to the audience, verbally and musically, that brought them closer into his world, into the things that he was about.
Ellington had a profound effect on many influential African-Americans across the country as well. John Edward Hassey.
Ralph Ellison encountered Ellington as a young man growing up in Oklahoma and wrote later with pride how Ellington's man had just inspired and thrilled him and his friends when they came to town. Gordon Parks talked about how Ellington didn't shuffle, he strode across the stage, how he didn't grin, he smiled elegantly. You know, the elegance of the man, the dignity, the style, were a source of a great racial pride for many people back then.
Thank you. Ellington's reach soon extended coast to coast with a nightly radio program broadcast live from the Cotton Club.
May we pause just briefly, ladies and gentlemen, to remind you that the Duke is on the air and that Columbia is taking you for your dancing pleasure to the Cotton Club on the Great White Way in New York City to bring you the music of Duke Ellington and his orchestra, which continues now with Ivy Anderson coming back to the microphone to sing On the Sunny Side of the Street.
The Ellington Orchestra in 1938, in a live broadcast from the Cotton Club. Ellington began to view his growing audience as a creative collaborator, one that could help him shape his works in progress. Billy Taylor.
Much of what helped him become the superstar that he ultimately became was the fact that much of this was on the radio. People heard it, and they heard it as a work in progress. I mean, they heard this tune. Now, they heard him coming on radio playing this thing when he hadn't decided what he wanted to do with it. So he figured, I'm going to hold him by the ear. I mean, if I can get him on when I'm doing these radio broadcasts, I'm going to grab him. And so he used all kinds of material within his grasp, some unfinished material, some things that perhaps he later rethought and took him out of circulation, but always with an idea of engaging the audience on a more creative level.
The notion of using his audience as a sounding board led Ellington to try things out on them. It was a learning process for him, and it was a way to educate them. Conductor David Berger and trombonist John Sanders.
He would show up at a theater or a dance or wherever it was that he was performing with the idea of how can I please this audience? And he would schedule pieces early in the program that he knew that his audience would love to hear. And once he had them in the palm of his hand, then he could play his newest and most outrageous piece and they would love it.
Duke was forever giving me a new score. Sometimes it was complete, sometimes it was just one chorus of a new piece. But it was all there, the orchestration, the harmony, who's going to play it and how it's going to be played. And he couldn't wait to hear it on the bandstand as soon as possible. I would come to the engagement, and I'd bring the new piece with me. I'd always had a little briefcase or a folder. And he said, John, you got it? I said, yes, Duke, I finished a chorus. He said, pass it out. And then somewhere, like we were playing a dance, Duke would incorporate this new piece into the dance set. And the audience wasn't even aware of what was happening.
By the early 1930s, Duke Ellington, the band leader, had captured the hearts and minds of his audiences as his self-confidence and artistry blossomed. Soon, his ensemble of hand-picked musicians would take the country by storm, as you will hear. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, our first look into the genius of Duke Ellington, the band leader, from NPR, National Public Radio. By the early 1940s, Duke Ellington's presence loomed large in the minds of the American public. The Ellington magic had an especially powerful effect on women. His granddaughter, Mercedes Ellington, remembers his routine when he played Satin Doll.
He would introduce it and dedicate it to the most beautiful woman in the room. And he said, he added that he didn't want to point her out because he knew that she knew who she was and she knew that they knew that she knew who she was, but they didn't want to embarrass her. And every woman in the audience would think that they were the one.
Dancer and actress Carmen de Lavallade.
And he always had a sense of humor. When he'd kiss you on each cheek. He said, I has to do it four times. He says, one for each cheek. He's really very, he'd whisper that in your ear. You know?
And he was not only tender with the ladies, but also with the children. Drummer Louis Belson.
Ellington, on many occasions, would refer to little people. He would say, little people are beautiful. Many times on the bandstand, if he would see a youngster who was really a drummer and came to hear me play with the band, he would say, come here, sit right there. And he'd get a chair and let him sit there all night long to watch me play with the Ellington band.
And the paternal instincts spilled over into his relationship with the band. He truly loved his players.
I don't think I know of one person, and that goes for an instrumentalist or a singer, that had an unkind word to say about Ellington. That's how complete he was. Everybody, when you worked with Ellington, he made you feel at ease. He worked with you, not against you. We worked collectively. He made you feel like we were all there together.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to have you know that the purpose of all of our personal appearances is to present our internationally celebrated instrumentalists in their solo responsibilities. And so now, Paul Gonzalez in the wailing interval of Diminuendo in Blue and Crescendo in Blue.
Both on stage and off. Band leader and clarinetist Don Byron.
Being in the Ellington band, I mean, you had a doctor, you had a dentist, you know, it was like having a real gig. It was like being in a symphony. And the value of being an Ellingtonian outside of the Ellington band, I mean, it was the most admired group. I mean, there was a lot of status to it.
Ellington was gifted with very good business sense, except when it came to letting band members go. Composer and conductor, Gunther Schuller.
Ellington was really incapable of firing a musician. I mean, he eventually fired Mingus, and he fired somebody else. So I think there are only two people in his entire career that he actually fired. He was, in that sense, a very soft-hearted, a gentleman, and just couldn't bring himself to get rid of somebody when he felt, actually, that they had outlived their usefulness.
His soft-hearted approach got him into even more trouble when it came to discipline. This was an unruly group of individualists who needed a strong hand at the helm. But that was not Ellington's way. He preferred to be the calm center of the storm. Trumpeter Clark Terry.
We'd go in, and there was never really a whole heck of a lot of discipline, because one of the things that Ellington always said is, remember, I am not a disciplinarian. I've gotten you all here, and you gathered here because of things that you can do. I know what you can do, and I know you can produce what I want done.
But this seemed to just open the door to trouble. Charles Mingus once chased Juan Tizol across the stage, waving a steel pipe. Other situations were explosions waiting to happen. Trumpeters Cootie Williams and Cat Anderson hated each other. They sat like bookends at either end of the trumpet section and refused to speak for years. But the biggest troublemakers were the drinkers. Drummer Louis Belson.
I remember one time there was a situation where Paul Gonzalez and Ray Nance were continually late for the bus. So that meant we would miss dinner because they were late maybe 2 hours. And people like Quentin Jackson, Butter, who liked to eat, you know, that meant no dinner for him. And you take food away from Quentin Jackson, you got fighting words on your head. That's it, you know. So the situation came, so Duke, you've got to do something. You've got to tell all the guys they got to be prompt. They have to be on time. So Duke got up in front of the bus, and he said, fellas, I want to talk to you about something. And Ray Nance said, Duke, sit down. And then Duke sat down, didn't say a word. The issue was never brought up. That was Ellington. He figured the guys have to work it out themselves.
Sometimes these guys would have a tendency to dribble in.
Vocalist Herb Jeffries.
And of course, in order for him to make that look right, he would purposely start the band off with two or three men and then have men walk in and join the band. So he would use that as a formula. Well, now you guys come in later, son.
Other times, Duke did have his own special way of getting the behavior he wanted from people. It wasn't exactly discipline, but it worked in a similar way.
Sometimes these guys have been sitting up there at the brass rail a little bit too long and feeling their cups. He would make them work harder, and he would get them up there and put them on, say, now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Provo, and he's going to play some songs for you. And he'd make him do six or seven courses of the same song, and that was a punishment. That's the way that he was able to to discipline them. And he did a very good job at it.
Singer Joya Sherrill marveled at the way he managed to deal with the complainers and the gripers, players forever on the verge of leaving.
I would always see guys, you know, into the dressing room, talking to him about something, and some of them were griping, and he was able to keep them in check. It's like Lawrence Brown, whom I loved. Lawrence Brown was going to leave the band every few hours. He was leaving. Every night we got on the bus, he said, I'm not taking this, I'm leaving. And he was, of course, with the band for many, many, many years, you know.
Clark Terry.
As you could see from the decorum sometime on the bandstand, there was all sorts of little things going on that were not considered to be acceptable, but he accepted them, and in the end, he got done what he wanted done, and that's all he was interested in.
Tenor saxophonist Paul Gonzalez with diminuendo and crescendo in blue. Ellington's focus was the music, not the distracting details, like his band members' paychecks. Herb Jeffries.
If you went to him for money, he would look at you and he would say, Hobby, you know I don't carry any money on me at all. Money is not what my interest is. My interest is music. You know music is my mistress. And if you want money, you have to see the man who handles money. That's our manager in the back. You go see him.
Ellington never thought about money, I mean, per se. Ellington was just going through life doing what he was doing.
Jazz impresario George Ween.
I don't think Ellington ever had a dollar in his pocket. But if he wanted to be on the phone all night long and build up a phone bill in those days of $150 a night, the manager of the band had to come along and pay that bill. And that was a lot of money, $150. Maybe it was $200 or $300. And if he wanted to go out, he just lived. I won't think that he said, I'm Duke Ellington and I can do whatever I want. But he was Duke Ellington and he did whatever he wanted.
It's a look into the genius of Duke Ellington, the band leader, on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. Ellington's financial oversights eventually caught up with him. In his last years, he reportedly owed the IRS millions in unpaid taxes. But there was one area of his life where self-discipline was always evident. That was music. He tended to produce work at the last minute, but he was iron-willed about composing. He was never satisfied unless he considered the music perfect, and he drove himself constantly to create new work. Drummer Louis Belson.
When I first joined the band, I roomed with Duke. And I only lasted for a week because Ellington stayed up all night writing music. He wrote music every day. And my bedroom was right by the front door. So every 5 minutes, there would be a knock on the door. Flowers from Mr. Ellington, 5 minutes later, telegram from Mr. Ellington. So I didn't get any sleep at all. So I finally had to go to Duke and say, Duke, if you want a good, solid, strong drummer who's fresh, you better let me get some sleep. So he started laughing. He said, I know what you're talking about. So then I got a room of my own, you know.
He wrote music whenever it came to him, anytime, anywhere.
But I remember one time he was sitting about five rows ahead of me, and he looked back at me and said, do you have any manuscript paper? And I said, no. And so he immediately got up, took his jacket off, he had a white shirt on, and he drew five lines on his sleeve, and he wrote eight bars of music on his sleeve. And he told me later, he says, always make sure you put that down because you'll never get that same eight bars if you wait later on.
Hallmark of Duke Ellington's perfectionism was the rehearsal studio. Ellington biographer John Edward Hassey considers the Ellington Orchestra one of the best prepared in the history of jazz.
For every hour the band is on stage, one very careful observer wrote, there are 2 hours of rehearsal. And in fact, it was at rehearsals that the band would not only work up polished new material, but that Ellington would often knead the dough of new compositions and try things out, ask a trumpet player to try this part and see how it sounded. And if it didn't sound good for one trumpet player, he might take the part away and give it to another trumpet player. And he might change the order of the sections. He would really experiment a lot at these rehearsals and also at his recording sessions when he had to premiere a new work.
Vocalist Joya Sherrill recalls the endless rehearsal process as well as the frantic pace as they tried to keep up with the stream of new work that Ellington kept pouring out.
Many times at a dance, Duke would be putting the new music up and that would be the rehearsal. So we rehearsed sometimes on the occasion of the show, and then after the show we'd have rehearsals. And Tom Whaley was the copyist. And many, many times I can remember Billy giving Tom the music. We're recording one thing, and Tom is diligently working on the next thing. It wasn't like finished when we came into the studio, but it would develop as we were working. We'd finish a song, and he's just about finished this one, and that's the way Duke worked.
He often encouraged the players to participate in the composing process. Pianist and educator Billy Taylor.
Many of the things that Ellington wrote with Ben Webster, with Cootie Williams, with Johnny Hodges, other well-known soloists of the band, many of those things came out of ideas which were a part of that person's vocabulary. Now, that's Ben Webster. That's the way Ben plays, and that was his riff. But that riff was expanded by Duke Ellington and into a composition that the band played.
Individuals to insert little bits and pieces of their own personality. For instance, on the end of one tune, da doo da doo da doo da doo da da. I started doing that on one occasion. He says, "Yeah, keep that in," you know. And he was just beautiful like that. So he had an idea that he could use all these people, use all their ideas, and still it would still be Ellington.
Ellington's band members and their musical personalities became the fabric of his music. Conductor and educator David Baker.
By the choice of the musicians with whom he worked, he made use of their idiosyncratic sounds, Bubba Marley, Tricky Sam Natten, the sound of Otto Hardwick. And he took advantage of all of those things instead of assuming that every alto saxophone player would get basically the same sound given this. And it's all of those things that I think led Ellington to begin to push the boundaries.
Duke always wanted the great personalities.
Trumpeter and bandleader Wynton Marsalis.
You have like the greatest musicians in the world playing it. People like Clark Terry, Cat Anderson. You just play lead trumpet in his band. You have to deal with Cat Anderson. Tenor saxophone, you have to deal with Paul Gonzalez. You play baritone saxophone, you have to deal with Harry Carney. Lawrence Brown, these are the greatest musicians you could find. Sam Woodyard, Sonny Greer. I mean, you're dealing with Johnny Hodges. I was just the greatest lead alto man that ever lived.
Johnny Hodges. Cootie Williams. Mm-hmm.
Stewart. Louis Belson. Fortunately for Ellington, his musicians were willing to deal with the sheer volume of music he presented to them. Trombonist John Sanders believes they sensed the larger significance of working on his compositions.
Musicians went beyond themselves. They were called in to make a contribution to something, and I think they sensed that. This is not just another orchestra leader or another arrangement doing a date. I think deep down inside there was that great respect. Duke is a master, he's a composer, and we are, you know, very happy to be a part of his world of music. And my instrument, whether it be a trombone or a trumpet or a saxophone, the bass or the drum, whatever, that just think I'm a part of this. And I think they took their assignments and gave it their best. Gave it their best. Most musicians considered being members of the Ellington Band the highest achievement they could aspire to in their professional lives. They played their best with him and rarely left. Ellington kept his orchestra at the ready to pursue and explore his own artistic vision. But he also transformed his musicians into an outstanding touring ensemble to share his gift with the world. Louis Belson.
He actually charged you. If you were down a little bit, well, he would goose you a couple of times and you'd say, yeah, why not? Here we go, straight ahead. But that was him. He made you use every fiber, whatever you had inside you, right from the tip of your toes right to the top of your head.
Clark Terry.
My impression was the same as anyone who anticipated or really dreamed of ever having an opportunity to perform with the Ellington Band. Was that, wow, if I could ever make that, you know. And then once you become a member of the organization, you're almost spellbound for a while, you know. You just can't fathom the fact that here I am. I am now a member of this marvelous organization, sometimes referred to as the New York Yankees. You know, I'm on the Yankees team now.
The Duke Ellington Orchestra was known for its creativity and quirkiness, but above all, for its musical excellence. It was a product of Ellington's key players, Johnny Hodges, Cootie Williams, Harry Carney, Clark Terry, and many, many others. Their stories are yet to come, and our next look at Ellington, the band leader.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody look handsome. Everybody.
Our look into the genius of Duke Ellington is written and produced for Jazz Profiles by Robert Levy. The executive producer is Tim Owens. The studio producer for this program is Molly Murphy. Associate producer, John McDonald. Assistant producers are Jennifer Raskin and Madeline Smith. Post-production engineer, Rima Snyder, with help from Todd Hulslander. We'd like to say thanks to our lead advisor, John Edward Hassey. Also, Susan Jenkins, Phil Schaff, Patrick Breslin, producer Margaret Howells, and NPR's Making the Music, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the Smithsonian's Duke Ellington Archives and their Jazz Oral History Program, and NPR's New York and Los Angeles bureaus. Special thanks to the New York Foundation for the Arts and to the New York State Council on the Arts for their support. This program is a production of National Public Radio in association with Smithsonian Productions, made possible in part by a grant from America's Jazz Heritage, a partnership of the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund and the Smithsonian Institution. To email us, or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.